Radio.
When I really want something badly, it really overrides fear in that moment. If I want it so badly, like every part of my being wants it, like I'm not gonna be thinking about the fall, I'm just gonna be like attacking.
Hey y'all, I'm Ryan Devlin, and welcome to the Struggle Climbing Show, where I talk with elite climbers about their struggles and breakthroughs in training, nutrition, tactics, and mental game. Now today we're chalking up for a chat with a climber who's made slab sexy and is now turning her sights to steeper stuff and also is just a creative powerhouse. I'm talking about Anna Hazelnut. Now Anna's climbing's evolved fast over the years and her thirst for improvement has been rewarded by a meteoric rise in the climbing world, both on and off the rock. Now a few noteworthy ascents include Once Upon a Time in the Southwest, which is an E96C or 513 BC rated R trad climb, becoming one of the first women to climb E9, and that was one of her first trad ascents ever. It's crazy. Anna then became the first woman to climb Walk of Life, which is an E9 or a 513D rated R or X, holy smokes. And since then, she's ticked an impressive list of climbs, including Spank the Monkey, 513D rated R, Prinzip Hoffnung, an E910 or 14A rated R trad climb. You probably saw her do in her film Hope with Tom Randall. And then just recently, she ticked the classic To Bolt or Not to Be, North America's first 514A, which she also documented beautifully on her YouTube channel. Now, Anna's always pushing to venture outside of her comfort zone and try new things. Slab, crack, off-width, ice, high balls, you name it, she's doing it. And she shares all of those ups and downs in vulnerable, beautiful, and also goofy ways, which I love, on her YouTube channel, which has just exploded over the past year. I'm sure you've seen it. Her film Hope, which she directed, has won 3 Best Sport Film Awards at international festivals so far, and has also been selected for some of the most prestigious mountain film festivals around the world. Anna's a strong advocate for inclusivity within the climbing community. She feels slab is sexy. She feels inclusivity is hot. We talk all about that here, because to her, it's not just about the ascents. It's about the journey and the people. This conversation was just an absolute joy. It is packed with useful beta. And it also went to some surprising places that I think you are going to love. Let's go. This episode is sponsored by Petzl. And if you've seen the videos of me on my project lately, y'all have seen me in my Hirundos harness by Petzl, which I absolutely love. Y'all, if you're a sport climber and if you're looking for something that's ultra light, ultra comfy, and does not get in the way at all as you make limit moves, this one is it. It's got fuse frame technology, which basically means that it's light, it's strong, and perhaps most important for me with my mental game, it gives me total peace of mind as I go for it and take a ton of falls in the process. And it is comfy when I'm taking those falls, let me tell you. Look, for me, Petzl is just synonymous with trust. From their gri-gri to their draws and helmets and harnesses, I gear up with Petzl, and I also gear my kiddos up with Petzl as well. They just make the best stuff. You can check out all that Petzl has to offer at your local gear shop, or you can swing on over to thestruggleclimbingshow.com/Petzl to access the inaccessible. And lastly here, just a big thanks to all you patrons and subscribers out there. Oh my gosh, I just dropped a banger bonus episode with Anna. I think it's like 45 or 50 minutes long. It is so, so good. And I'm going to tell you more about that at the end here. But first, let's push outside our comfort zone with Anna Hazelnut. So cool to meet you. It's one of those funny things where I feel like I know you because I watch you like in your most of the stuff that you put out, like whether your shorts or your films that you do and all that, it's you. I mean, it's a version of you because everything that we do is a version of us, but I feel like I know you even though I don't know you. And I'm sure you get that quite a bit.
I get that all the time. Yeah. People like will come up and just start to like hug me or be like, oh my gosh, hello. And then realize it's a little bit awkward because I don't know who they are.
Right.
Like, oh, like, have we met? And like, oh no, we haven't. I'm so sorry. And like, it's always happening.
It's great. Yeah. In my prior life, prior
to moving to Kentucky here, I lived in Los Angeles and my career was as an actor. So I did like a lot of TV shows, I hosted a bunch of stuff. And very similarly, I would be like, it doesn't happen that much anymore, although it still does. But back when I was like doing a lot of TV stuff, like I would be at the grocery store and people would come up and they'd be like, hey,
we went to high school together, right? What's your, and I'm like, no, I didn't. I'm like this murderer on this TV show. That's probably why you recognize me.
Yeah, like your face where like, I know you from somewhere. So it must be like from high school or from college or something.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
I get that sometimes too. A little bit less now, just because I kind of stick out with blue hair and stuff like that.
Yeah, I was gonna say you now more have a bit of a trademark with the bangs, which are rad, by the way. I love that. Did you do that? I feel like I saw like the first time you shared that you were out in J Tree. Maybe is that when that happened?
For the hair or for the bangs?
For the hair, the blue, like the turquoise.
Blue. Yeah, the blue was in right before a J Tree photo shoot, random thing I did with one of my best friends, Irina. We don't even know why we did it. I was just like, let's just do a photo shoot. We're going to do a girls' weekend. So we just did a photo shoot. And I had new blue hair. And I was really excited. It was like, I dyed it like 3 days before. I was like in my bathroom with blue hair dyed. I was like, I hope this looks good because we have a photo shoot in 3 days.
Did you have to bleach? Did you have to go white first?
Yeah. And it looked just awful. It was like the weirdest. I don't know. I really didn't like the blonde. I was like panicking a little bit. And I was like, quick. And I like ran to the store and grabbed blue hair dye. And I was like, I've got to fix this.
It's working.
It's like so close to my skin tone, like the bleached hair, like the blonde. It just like blends right in with my skin tones. Oh, we can't have that. That's horrible.
Like you had like a receding hairline or something like that.
I was like, this looks so bad.
Well, I frequently have Tom on the show, usually like once a month or so we connect. And often when I publish one of our episodes, I publish a photo of him where it's like the worst haircut you've ever seen in your life. I think he was trying to make it the worst haircut, but it's buzzed in like weird spots and the bangs come out and all that. And I'm always like, Tom Randall's back on the show. And then I post like the ugliest photo you could possibly post of him. And I think he gets a good kick out of it. I don't know. Maybe he doesn't. But it's like now it's become like a bit of a runner.
Yeah, he loves that. He like, he always has like random haircuts. Even in Thailand, I think he had just like a couple spots. It was really funny.
I think, I don't know if it was when you all were doing Prinsip or maybe he was in Thailand. Or no, maybe it was when he was just out here in the desert. There was a photo of him working. I think maybe it was when he was doing Stranger Than Fiction or something like that, working on that. And his hair looked so normal. Like it looked like a normal, a business person would comb their hair. And I sent him a message and I was like, what's happening here? This doesn't seem right. And he's like, you know, the funny thing is that was like day six without a shower. I guess like the longer I go, like the more normal my hair looks. It's like totally opposite from what happens with most people.
Yeah, I love climbing with Tom. I wish we could climb together more. We just live on opposite sides of the world. But yeah, he's the best.
The last time I talked to him was right before, it was like a day before you all went to Thailand. And he and I have been messaging since, but we haven't connected on a call. We're going to, I think, talk in the next couple of weeks. But that looked like a hell of a trip.
Yeah, it was amazing. Oh my gosh. It's like the best trip I've ever taken. It was incredible. Like we went right to work. I feel like we showed up and that day we had an itinerary. Tom showed up at 7 a.m. and I had shown up, I think, at 1 or 2 a.m. And then I got a little bit of sleep. Unfortunately, Tom didn't really get too much sleep because like right away we were like, okay, we're in Bangkok. We're going to meet the climbing team. We're going to climb. We're going to do this video. And then we're going to go here and there. And it just was nonstop. And I love that. I think both Tom and I are pretty like chaotic and high energy. So like right when we were like, we hit the ground running, we were both really excited. We're like, oh yeah, we don't even need to sleep. We're just about to go do 100 things in a row.
Yeah, you two, you both seem to have pretty endless amounts of energy reserves. So it doesn't surprise me that like when together, it's like you're like this nuclear charged reaction and just like, let's take on Bangkok, which is like also the biggest, craziest, most energetic freaking place on the planet as well.
We're like zipping through on the motorbikes and stuff. We're like, didn't we just get here a few hours ago?
So good. I can't wait to dive into that. I want to explore so many things. I'm just catching sound check stuff. Maybe I'll use this. Maybe I won't. I don't know. I edit everything. For time and pacing and all that. I'm super excited for this. And listeners and patrons are really excited. I got a million questions for you, none of which, well, I won't be able to get to all of them, but some really thoughtful ones as well. And we'll start the show where we always start the show, which is with struggle. And what does struggle mean to you as a rock climber?
Yeah, I love that that's like in your title for the podcast, because I feel like it's such a good word for an athlete or for a climber specifically. Struggle to me is, oh my gosh, like a combination of hardship and but like the grit to also get through it. Like I think it implies not stopping, and it implies like a dynamic continuation of something hard that you're struggling through. And that's why I like the word so much too. It's not a block, right? So that's what struggle is to me. It's like the act of getting through something hard.
Yeah, I like that kind of the verb nature of it. There's action there to it. It's interesting. I just watched your film, To Bolt or Not to Be, that congratulations. What a climb. We'll talk all about that. Yeah. But one of the things that you have had a history of doing with the content that you put out is to, I think, embrace the vulnerability around the struggle and the process and failure or setbacks and this kind of thing. And that was quite apparent in To Bolt or Not to Be, as well as many of the other films that you've put out there. And I'm curious if that's always been the case. Have you always embraced that and been able to emote it and share it kind of publicly, whether it was in your circles or beyond? Or is that something that you've had to almost practice and develop?
I'm like a pretty highly emotional person. I've always been like super sensitive, like high sensitivity. Like in school, if I got yelled at, I would just cry. I don't know, really big emotions, I think. Or when I was really happy, I would cry. Like, you know, but tears of joy. So like, I've always lived with such intense emotions. I feel like, I don't know, like someone else on drugs or something. That's like my normal life.
Right.
And I think what YouTube and like social media and everything and like adulthood has let me do is, instead of get embarrassed, although I do still sometimes get quite embarrassed, but like instead of making that, I don't know, a point of weakness maybe or something that I'm ashamed of, I've just learned to embrace it because it's so intrinsically part of me. So I think like it's almost out of necessity. If I was going to be a public figure, if I was going to be myself, I couldn't hide such a big part of me. And so rather than take it into a negative space, I just put it into a positive space. Yeah, I think it's all part of self-acceptance along those lines, because it's who I am, and I'm not trying to hide it really. So I think that's why it shows through so much, because I like to be honest in my films and portrayal.
Yeah, I really appreciate it as the viewer. Part of the reason I created this show, this format here, and call it The Struggle is because I do feel that oftentimes in climbing media or what people post is the end point of the process or the triumph, or maybe you show a little bit of, you know, struggle and then it's, oh, and then I did the thing. But there's a universality to, you know, whether I'm trying to break into 5'11 sport climbing or somebody's trying to break into 5'15. There's a little bit of that, like we're kind of like on this journey together.
Yeah, at least a lot of the comments that I read and like the feedback I get from people is that when they watch my films or when they follow me on Instagram, it's just so relatable. So I think it's just hitting a note that is universal, yeah, between all of us climbers and humans, right? Like we all experience these emotions, maybe not in the same way, but at least we can understand that side of the story. That's also why I like telling it too. It just feels honest rather than, I don't know, not saying anything and then posting a picture and being like, I did it. And I am guilty of that, actually. I've been realizing that I don't really like to post the process that much. And I'm trying to like delve into why. And I'm like, oh, maybe I'm like, I don't know. I still am not like showing everything. Like I'm vulnerable only after I've done it. So I'm working on that too and sharing the steps along the way. I think that's like the next step for me. We'll see. It's a little scary, isn't it?
Ooh, that's interesting. Yeah, I hadn't thought about that because obviously once you've done the thing, then you know what the final act is and you can build up the conflict and the struggle and the vulnerability. But of course, in real time, so you're talking about in the process of projecting, like Will was on, you know, Return to the Sleepwalker or something like that, doing all these updates and like, you don't know if it's going to happen or not. There's a certain level of vulnerability there or uncertainty there that you haven't embraced yet.
Yeah. I talked to Will about that when I went to Red Rock with him. And I was like, I think it's so admirable and how vulnerable you are doing this. And I think maybe he hadn't framed it in that way because he's like, well, it's such a cool climb. I love the process. I don't know. I just felt like he had this like deeper understanding of projecting than I have. And maybe that's because I feel like I'm just tiptoeing into like harder projects. Like I keep doing my projects in a season or in a few weeks. So I think I haven't gotten to the point where I can accept failure as an option. Do you know what I'm saying? Like I've been like working in my comfort zone enough. Like obviously To Bolt was not that comfortable because I didn't have that much time to do it. But maybe if I'd given myself I don't know, a few extra weeks or something, like doubled the time, maybe it would have just been like, oh yeah, this is super chill. I think that's really admirable. I think Stefano does the same thing, Gisolfi. I think he also shows like the process of everything he's doing without any need for ascend. I think it's really beautiful. I really want to start doing that. I think I just have to start the next project I do. I'm like, okay, just do it. It's going to be fine. That's what climbing is.
Speaking from experience, as I very publicly stated, my climbing goal last season was to climb my first 513A, and it has not come together yet. And so now I'm like, God, why did I talk about it? Like, why? Because now I'm like, I can't walk away. I got people asking me. And so it definitely like, it kind of cuts both ways on. I think you're going to handle it just fine. You do really well with all your stuff. But there are times where I wake up and I'm like, man, why didn't I just like state that I wanted to climb my first 11D or something like that?
No, it's good. You're being held accountable. I dealt with a lot of that with Tobolt because it's right in the middle of the park and everyone knows I'm going for it. Like, I love Smith Rock. That's no surprise. Everyone knows I'm in Smith Rock and it's okay, what's she going to be doing? Right. Obviously, Tobolt. So there is no hiding that one. And every time people would walk by, because it's like right in, like, have you been to Smith Rock?
I haven't been there, but I do know, like, it's like the face, right?
It's like the face. Like, everyone has to walk by it to get, and everyone's like, how's it going? I'm like, yeah, punch it at the top again. Everyone's, ooh, or I'm just like, everyone, and even people I don't know, they're asking because they're like, oh my God, is that to bolt or not to be? And I'm like, yeah. And so you have the same conversation every day that you sit right there and you're just like, still haven't done it, dealing with it a little bit. Maybe that's why I didn't want to post. I was like, you know.
That'll be so interesting to see to follow along as you wade into those waters. And speaking of Tom and Stranger Than Fiction, that was something that he went through and experienced and got so heartbreakingly close right before his trip ended. And he and I spoke about that after he got back. And I think that seems to be some good value of sharing those struggles in real time and not knowing the outcome, internal and external value, I think. And you also, I think, more than not, probably get a lot of support from the community. There's always going to be the trolls, but more than not, people are going to be like trying to lift you up and build you up along the way, I think.
Yeah. And I think it also sends a message that it's not just about the send. And I think for climbing, it can be so black and white sometimes for people. Did you do it or did you not? But I've always felt like that's really limited. And I even feel like when you're climbing something, there should be, I don't know, more of a discussion about how you climbed it and like, how did it feel? Did it flow? Because like when you're flashing something, for instance, like sometimes you like really struggle through it, right? You're like gripped, you're yelling, you're like, this is so sloppy, but I'm doing it. And you get to the top and you're like, I sent it. And that's the same verbiage for maybe a flash that you, I don't know, you like flow, you find the sequences, you're in the zone, you're trying hard, but you get to the top. You know how like there's such different experiences and we don't have anything to do that. Like, oh yeah, that was an A+ send, or oh no, that was like B minus. Like, we don't have that. And I think, right. I don't know, I feel like it almost, the way that we talk about climbing takes away from the process, which is the like most of it. So it's kind of weird that we don't have more of a conversation about that.
Yeah, the vocabulary lacks. We can feel it. You can feel like what you just said, but it's just, it's hard to find like the little green check mark emoji is just such an easy thing to post. Like, what's the emoji where it's like, I really felt the process and I didn't send, but I'm more proud of the work that I did in not sending than when I did send.
Which emoji is that one? Is it, do we get an emoji?
Like a little Hazel Finlay emoji. We just need a little picture of Hazel and then that's, everybody knows.
Everyone knows you're psyched. You have that mindset. Yeah.
It's about the process. It's the process. He posted the Hazel emoji. He's really doing great. He didn't send, but he's really learning so much.
There's a little hazelnut too, right? Isn't there a hazelnut emoji that I could start just using my own emoji and just put that in there? I don't know.
This is a whole new line of merch that
I'm creating this. Yeah.
Totally.
Only available for slab climbs.
We're already rewriting the playbook for how we talk about our sends. One way to kick off the conversation, struggle is usually the entry point here, but then we've taken it into this whole new direction. So yeah, keep us posted on the hazelnut emoji. And let's take the stoke here and harness it and focus it into training for a little bit. I want to talk about training specifically. And I know you're going to be training after this conversation, so maybe it's already on your mind. It's always on our minds. We're climbers. But let's enter through the lens of struggle. And where have you or where do you struggle with your training?
For the longest time, I struggled just to train. Training as a concept was something I wasn't a fan of. I just like to climb, and training was just not high on the priority list for like six years. I've been climbing for 10 years now. So I feel like for most of my climbing life, I was just kind of like weekend warrioring it, like going to the gym, doing absolutely no training and just having so much fun with it. So I think in my head, the struggle was viewing training as fun, because I'm like, well, it has to be as fun as climbing if I'm going to do it. And my mindset has completely changed since then. Like, I really enjoy training now. I love like how healthy it makes me feel. And it's like prehab, right? You do it and then you don't get as injured because you're stronger in every way. And the progress is undeniable. Like in the last few years, I've just shot up because of training. And that feels good. That's fun for me. I think progress is fun. So yeah, after I overcame that struggle, I guess like now the struggle is like figuring out how to fit everything in to a week schedule. I'm like, I want to train all of these things, because as a climber, you want to train everything.
Sure.
And like you want to train everything all the time. Like I want to train all my finger grips. I want to train like half crimp, full crimp, drag. I want to do pull-ups. I want to do like these weights for my arms, for my legs. And it's just like, for me, I'm like, oh my God, how am I going to fit this all in 1 week without dying, like, and giving myself proper rest? So yeah, that's where I want to do too much.
Yeah. And can it be done, or do you need to make choices based on where you're at or a trip or a project? Do you let things slide, or do you try to keep things topped up throughout the year?
Lately I haven't been training just because I've been doing a lot of trips, like the Thailand Asia trip, but these last 2 weeks I've gotten back into training, and I've literally just have just been doing the longest hangboard routine just to see what, I don't know, what, like how long it'll take if I want to train all my grips at once. And I'm like, okay, maybe I should just pick a few. So right now I'm in an experimental stage with my training, and I'm going to focus in on specific elements of training for specific projects. And I think that's the way to go. Mm-hmm. So I really do a lot of crimps in my outdoor climbing. So fingers is going to be a priority, but maybe legs won't be. I'll like squeeze in one leg squat or something like that.
Oh, that's why I'm mapping out. I don't feel like you probably need to train much legs, but you know, yeah. I guess it depends on the project, right? If there's a project that's like super leg intensive, then maybe that would become the focus.
Yeah, exactly. So I don't know. It's exciting too, isn't it? Like entering a new training block and I'm like, oh, okay, what project do I want to do? What do I need? I'm working on power right now. So I'm trying to boulder more and project more on boulders, which I think is really cool because I've been in such like a sport trad mindset that it's hard to sometimes activate that like pure boulder power. So that's my quest right now. And then hopefully after I feel more powerful, like kind of transition into power endurance and get ready for longer projects that are on you. I think getting stronger is going to help a lot for me.
On the power phase, like, or like you're focused now on that, kind of like on the bouldering, where are you doing that? Is that at the gym or outdoors?
Yeah, like a mix. Yeah. It'll be like gym and outdoors. Yeah. But just focusing, I think for me, it's the projecting process. Like until this year, I swear I wasn't projecting at gyms or outside. I've just, I don't know, either do it or I don't. And then my projects are usually like one line that I go to do. So I'll pick a project and that's a project. But every other form of climbing is just, did I onsite it or did I not? And then next. And it's just, I don't know, it's like weird. Like I haven't been able to bring that mentality to bouldering and to other aspects of climbing. So I'm really working on that. Like at the gym, I went back to a climb I had tried the last session and it felt so weird. I was like, whoa, okay, let's see if I make progress on this. Like for me, I don't know why it's like a new concept for me, but I'm like, I'm going to go back to this gym project I have. So I'm excited. I think there's a lot to be gained from bouldering right now.
As long as the projects are still up, usually I get like strong and I'm like, I'm going to go do it. And I get in there and they're resetting.
Damn. I know.
Have you been doing any work on boards, a Kilter, TB2, moon board, any of that kind of thing?
Yeah. I'm trying to add in more system boarding because it's obviously a way to get power. On the moon board in the past, I've done like circuits on the moon board. And I think that's great training for sport climbing. And so I try to like factor those in. I'm going to try like once a week or so after some good power. I think it's great, especially if your sport climbs that you're focusing on or trad or whatever are just like endurance fests. I think just going up and down on the moon board like as many times as you can and repeating that a lot, I think that's good. Basically, like my training is like hell. I love it.
Yeah. It's like I had a conversation with Michaela Kirsch. She was talking about her training for La Rambla, and she said that she was doing like 50 move circuits on the moonboard. And I'm like, look, even the easiest ones, I can get 5 moves on that. I need like the moonboard to be adjustable like a kilter, so I can just bring it up to like 10 degrees and then I can do a circuit.
You can use any feet first and just use all feet on. That's what I do.
Yeah,
I saw that with Michaela, actually, and I was like, I wonder how many moves I'm doing. So I actually counted the moves of my next project, and I was like, okay, so I want to be getting up to like 30 or 40 for the crux, maybe 30, because I had 20-something, I forget now. And then I was like doing, I think, 26. I was like getting up there on the moonboard circuit, so that was like cool. I wasn't at 50, but like, oh, we'll try to get there this time.
Crazy impressive. It's really great. I'm motivated to get out to the moonboard. I think can be a great tool if you're able to go into that pain cave. I want to ask you about the 9C challenge that you did and what you learned from it, and if you think it's bullshit or if it's applicable to climbers.
I've done it twice now because YouTube. So I did it for my channel like a year before or whatever, and then I did it again with the Hoopers boys. And I feel like because I had done it before, it actually gave me a lot of insight because I could see how my numbers had changed, and especially because I'm starting to take training more and more seriously. Like every year I train for like an extra few weeks or something. Like I'm not very good at training, but I'm like training more and more now. And so it was really cool because like I just dramatically improved from the last year after one training block. And I was like, oh my gosh. So I think in that sense, it's really cool to have, I don't know, this gauge. And now that I've done it and I've done it twice, I could do it again and see where I am. And I feel like it gives you that, I don't know, that motivation of like, wow, look how far I've come, or, oh wow, this hasn't improved at all. Maybe I should focus on this. But in general, like I wouldn't use it to train or anything like that. Like I wouldn't do it as a training day. And I don't know how applicable hanging from a bar is. Like, I don't know, some of the challenges, I guess, within it feel like maybe they're testing something that you could just train in a better way. Like, I wouldn't go training hanging on a bar, if you know what I mean. Like, I would just hang board.
Right. It's effectiveness as a tool to try to predict what kind of grade that you might be able to climb.
Surprisingly, like, it was pretty good. Like, I think it got me right where I was at the time. Like, it put me at 8B or something like that for sport. And for me, I'm like, that's actually pretty good. Like, I don't know if it was trying to tell you what your max grade is, what your projecting grade is, or what, like, your comfortable grade is. I'm not really sure, but I feel like I've done a lot of 8Bs, like, too many. It's like that grade that, like, it, like, bunches up at the top because, like, no one wants to make it, like, a 14A. They're like, it's 13D, 13D. So I've done so many 13Ds. And at the time, I was actually just complaining about, like, I'm like, I just wish some of these were, like, I could try some more 14s. All these cool climbs are at this grade 13D. And then I did the test and it tells us, you're a 13D climber. And I'm like, oh, great. Like, that's super accurate. That's all I do these days is 13Ds. So I think it was, like, weirdly accurate. But what I do think is at the higher grade, that's going to be more accurate because you do need, like, certain baseline strengths to climb higher grades. I think it's just more applicable, even though I know the test was like totally made up, but I do feel like it's quite accurate at the top. But like at the lower grades, I think there's such an imbalance. Like you can be a really strong climber who just doesn't have any technique and there's no way you can climb the grade that it gives you. Or yeah, like at the lower grades or like V0 to 5 or whatever they said for sport climbing, like maybe the 10s, 11s, 12s, I think it can just be a mess.
Yeah, because so much else comes into play there beyond like finger strength. But to your point, as you get to the higher grades, there's a kind of a common denominator of movement and technique mastery that is usually had by then. So then it can become a little bit more of just like this objective measure of strength. And can you remind us listeners, just who maybe haven't seen that video in a while, what were the metrics that you all were testing as part of that?
Yeah, we were doing, so it was hanging on a 20 millimeter edge. It was, let's see if I remember all of them. It's a max pull-up, 2 pull-ups in a row. So just like with as much weight as possible. It's front lever, or you can also tuck your knees in from hanging on a bar. There's 2 levels to that challenge. And then the fourth one is hanging. I can't, not without one leg like tucked in.
One leg out.
Yeah, I'm like, I'm working up to a front lever, but I can't do one yet. So I just do the two knees tucked.
Sure.
And then the the fourth challenge is hanging from a bar with two hands, and you can't like readjust and you can't like let go. You have to just hold it and stay.
To failure.
Yeah. And those are the four challenges. And you do them all, except for the bar hanging one, that's just by time, but you do them all as percentages of your body weight. So that's how it, I think, makes it more of a level playing field.
Okay. What's interesting, I guess, maybe the biggest takeaway here is that it's not necessarily any one of those individual tests that have some sort of magic sauce to it, but the value that you got was that you did it and then sometime later did it again, and you could essentially see where your training was having it, the biggest effect or not. And so what were those takeaways? Like, what were the big leaps and where were maybe the not so big leaps, or was it just big all around?
It was big all around, but I was really surprised that like the challenge that I thought was least applicable, like when I was just complaining about the bar hanging from a bar challenge, I was like, why are we doing this? That's where I hung for so long the second challenge and I couldn't do it the first challenge. I did it in the UK with Pete and I remember really feeling miserable and then just capping out and falling off the bar. And then this time around, the last time, I think I hung for 5 minutes and I was like, oh my God, that's kind of crazy. That's such a big change. So that was surprising. That might be like grit over physical gains. But another one too was the fingerboarding, because at the time, like 2 years, so maybe this was like 2 or 3 years ago, I hadn't really been fingerboarding like or hangboarding and stuff. So I didn't really even know how to like hang super well. And I think it's awkward when you don't do it so much because you're like, is this really supposed to test finger strength? Mm. Like I remember I was climbing 13C, I believe, before I could hang for 3 seconds on the 20 mils. Like, I just couldn't hang on the hangboard. And then I was, like, climbing outside. So it's obviously there's a technique thing there. It's not my fingers. So there's, like, this bit of learning. And so the next time that I did the test, which was, I guess, last year, I was able to just, I knew how to hang them. I had been hanging them. And I was like, I've got this. And I really jumped up in my 20 mil.
Yeah, there is that interesting aspect of, like, there's strength, but then there's the ability to apply that strength to a sport-specific move or situation. And have you found, because you started with far more dialed movement and technique and then have been adding strength on top, it sounds like. Have you found that as you get stronger, you're able to apply it? Or does getting stronger make you less coordinated in a sense?
No, it's so cool. Like, I can just hold holds now. I'm, like, excited about it. Like, even yesterday, I was climbing with my little sister on these, like, comp climbs that they had on the sport wall at our home gym. And I was, like, I was leading, right? And she's learning how to belay. So I was just, like, okay, watch me here. And then I'm, like, this next hold looks bad. And it looks bad. And then I just grab it. And I'm, like, oh. And then I just keep holding it. And then I'm, like, okay, watch me here. This next. And I'm, like, oh, my God, I can just hold this. I was, like, so excited. I can just hold holds now. I don't know if that's really what you were asking, but yeah, I haven't gotten like more clunky. I just surprise myself constantly that I can hold, like I can pinch things. I can do slip. Like I just have so much more strength and I'm like not used to it yet. Like I'm not used to that in my body. So I think I still move like I'm not going to have strength. So I'm sure I find really efficient body positions because that's just kind of maybe like a trademark of my climbing. But then I can hold them now and it like is so exciting for me. Oh,
that's like leveling up in the biggest way because what I was getting at was essentially that, which is this, like you can get to the point where you're so strong where you're not climbing well, but you can still do it because you're just essentially muscling a climb, which is the opposite end of the spectrum, I think, is from where you were at or where you entered in, which was very efficient, hypermobile, really applying the minimum amount of strength necessary to maybe complete a series of moves. Whereas on the opposite end of the spectrum is maybe a little bit more where I'm at, although I'm not particularly strong, but I don't think I have very good technique and movement. And so I'll often be like just bruting through moves where I'm sure when I see other friends get on and they twist their hips and they're like beautiful back steps and flags and all that. And I'm like, oh, I think you just used a lot less energy than I did doing the same thing.
Yeah, whenever I feel like I brute through a movement or through like a boulder or something at the gym, I'm always like I'll have like this little like scrunch in my nose because I'm like, oh, I didn't like that. And so I'll just redo it in a way that feels more graceful. So I think maybe part of it is also that I just don't like the feeling of bruting through something. And sometimes you have to. Like often I'll be like, do I just have to campus that? I'm like, there must be another way. And I'm like heel hooking at my hand and I'm doing all these things that are obviously like they require more strength. And then eventually I was like, I'll just campus it. And then I can now, which is funny because I'm like, oh, yeah, okay, I can campus this. But I think part of it is I don't like the way that feels in my body when I climb like that. Like, I like to feel flowy, and I'll redo a climb if it doesn't feel good. Like, maybe not outside, like on a project or something like that. But like, if I'm in a gym and I'm bouldering and it feels clunky, I'm just like, let's redo that. I don't think I did that so well. So maybe that's part of it too.
I like that. I think that's a really cool exercise for me and maybe anybody else who is in this world. Like, because you can tell when you're just like, I'm just going to lock off and muscle past this thing or whatever. Like, you can tell the difference when it doesn't flow, and maybe just repeating it and doing it a second or third time to try to find a little bit more flow will help to support those neural pathways or whatever it is in terms of reinforcing the movement. I remember talking to Alex Magos on this show, and he said he would oftentimes drop off of a climb if his feet cut and he didn't want his feet to cut. He would just let go and say, I'm just going to start over. Because, like, to him, like, style is everything. And so I would never drop off intentionally in the middle of my project. But I can see how that could be very important to try to embrace a little bit more.
In the same similar vein, too, because people don't usually climb how I climb, and they usually don't see the beta how I see the beta. So when I'm climbing with anyone else, there's always a different beta being used. And so if I send it, I also like to keep being social and climbing with them, and I'll try it their way. And I think that's really fun too. So it's like also the flip side. And I think both are cool, right? Like, I think if someone does a different beta, I don't know, some guys were dynoing through this climb that I did really delicately. And I was like trying my gym project just to the left. And I was like, do you guys just dyno that? And they're like, yeah, we're trying to dyno past it. And I was like, can I try too? We ended up just dynoing, so unnecessary, but it was so cool. And I was like, wow, that was awesome. Thanks. And I just dropped off after the move because I was like, I did the rest. I just wanted to do that movement because it was like so different. I couldn't like stay away. So if I see someone at the gym doing something I've done totally different, I'll just bop over and be like, hey, how'd you do it like that? And try it their way.
I love that. I really think that's a great exercise. And also, if you can't afford a coach, you can just basically go like spy on people climbing and then just try the thing they did.
Yeah. And you make friends that way too. I mean, don't be like a dick about it. Like, don't go and just flash their project, but like, be like, oh, I did it this way. Do you mind me trying this beta? People are usually really like supportive and sometimes know who I am, and it's fine. So maybe I just get away with it because I'm like extra like nice and bubbly and I go up to them. But I like
socially getting out of your comfort zone, because in your 100K video, you were like, it was really hard for you to ask people to subscribe to your channel. And now you're like going up and asking people if you can dyno their proj.
Yeah. I've come a long way. Who knows what's coming up next? That's kind of outrageous. I know, I'm like, can I dyno your proj with you?
I love it. It's great. No, that'll be a future video. Let's talk about nutrition for a little bit here. And talk me through like your nutrition game, and have you struggled with anything? Like, what's nutrition like for you?
So if you watch the 100K video, you'll probably know that I don't really like vegetables. I am getting better though, because I'm just cooking them with better things, and then they taste like the better things. So I'm working on vegetables. But generally, I feel, aside from that, I do eat a lot of fruit, which I feel like kind of makes up for my lack of vegetables, my like minimal vegetables every day. But I do think I eat pretty healthily generally. And the main thing is that I try to get protein in all the time every day. So I make protein shakes, I'll have protein bars. I just try to make sure my protein is good. And last year for like 2 weeks, I tracked my calories just to make sure I was also getting like enough calories, and also to know how much is enough, because I hadn't really thought about nutrition too much. And so I got Macro Factor and I just like weighed everything. And I like was like, what am I eating this week? And then the next week I was like, okay, let me make sure I'm hitting my protein marks. And I was actually like pretty on top of it. I would say nutrition is really important, and it's something I'm like actively thinking about. But also, I don't know, it's not like the highest on my list, I guess. Like, I feel confident that I'm eating enough and that I'm getting enough protein. And that
what's the protein goal? Is that like a factor of how many pounds you weigh, you know, like a gram per pound or that kind of thing?
Yeah, I don't quite make a gram per pound. I'm a little under that. But as long as it's like roughly like 80%-ish, I'm pretty happy for the day.
And you're getting that through Whole Foods and bars or shakes? Or
I do eat meat and fish. So I've been trying to cut down on red meat, but I've been eating a lot of fish. I just came from Japan and then Vancouver, where fish is like so good. Oh, so yeah, mainly fish right now at the moment, I will say.
Yeah, cool.
You know what? Nutrition does take a really big dip when I'm like emotional, and I've been like depressed the last few weeks. So I think my nutrition is the first thing that takes a hit. So I think that is like something that I would say I struggle a lot with, is just eating food when I'm sad. Shakes help.
Yeah. Do you mind? First of all, I appreciate you just being vulnerable and opening up about that. I think that's common for a lot of people. All right. We can.
Yeah.
I am like, as soon as, whether it's stress or depression, or usually those two, it's usually stress or depression is like when I like,
yeah,
for me personally, is when I like really start eating a lot of sugar. Like I just crush chocolate. Like I love chocolate all the time. I've got a terrible sweet tooth, or a beautiful sweet tooth, however you want to look at it. But like, I can always tell that like when I'm really stressed or I'm depressed or sad, that's when like all of that ticks up. And for you, is it the quality of food that changes, or is it the quantity of food that changes?
It's the quantity, just because when I'm depressed or sad, like how I've been, I feel like I don't have control over a lot of things. Like I don't have control over my emotions. I don't have control over like how my body decides to feel when it wakes up. It's just bleh. It's like sad. It's tired. So the one thing I can control is food. So unfortunately, that also, like, it's funny because it feels like control, but of course it's like that's also a loss of control because I don't eat enough. And I like try to, I'm like, I won't eat anything unhealthy, really. Like I wouldn't do that to my, I don't know, I get like really intense about, I'm just gonna have really healthy things and not even that much, and it's just like, it gets into a really bad mindset, and my body suffers for it. Like it's not good. Like food restrictions never good. And luckily I live with my family, so they come up and they will check in and bring me little like protein shakes, like Orgain. Have you had Orgain from like Costco? It's like literally like gaining like protein shakes. And so I have those around the house, and like really high caloric foods. So if I don't feel like eating, I'm like, okay, we're just going to eat like the highest calorie foods possible then, because like, I'm not going to lose my muscles because I'm sad.
Thank you for sharing that. I think, again, that's something people can relate to, that whether it's this seasonal affective disorder, like a lot of people are going through this time of year as we're starting to pull out of it and get into the spring here, or just the normal ups and downs of life and stress and family and love and heartbreak and all the things that we go through as dynamic human beings. Yeah. Food is an emotional, it's like an emotional relationship that we have with ourselves, essentially. Yeah. And what foods make you happy?
Usually I have a big sweet tooth as well. Like I love, like there's chocolate in my desk. Like, I just have it here because I love chocolate and candies and stuff. Scones, anything baked goods.
Yeah, pastries all day. Yes.
Love it. But also I love food. That's why it's so weird that when I'm sad that leaves. I mean, it's almost like I don't want myself to experience joy or something. Like if I can't be happy, I can't be happy. It's like, I don't know what it is. It's definitely emotional, but I love food. Like, every time I travel, I'm trying to get to, like, I do extensive research on, like, restaurants where I'm going to go and what I'm going to eat. And that me and my friend Emil went to Japan, and the first day I signed us up for a food tour, I was like, we're doing a food tour. Like, we're going to go for 5 hours. We're going to go and taste the food around Tokyo.
Yes.
So it was, like, high priority.
So you're adventurous. Like, you'll try the crazy local thing, like the blowfish that, like, 1 in 20 will kill you or whatever.
That's why I got food poisoning. I was like vomiting on the floor after Bangkok because I was just like trying all the foods. I'd rather try the thing on the menu that looks the weirdest. So I'm not like I won't pick the safe options. And then of course I'll end up with like tummy issues all the time. But I'm so experimental.
This episode is brought to you by the Force Board. Are you guys into training your fingers? Dumb question. You're a climber. You're obviously obsessed with your finger strength. And let me tell you, the Force Board is just a huge step up from hangboarding. Now, if you're not familiar with what a force gauge is like this, it's a little digital device that you connect to your phone. And then as you pull on a block or a portable hangboard, it tells you exactly the force that you're using. So you don't need to mount a hangboard on a wall. You don't need to hang weights or pulleys to get the desired training stimulus. And then you can track your data seamlessly and program your workouts right in the app. And training fingers this way, instead of doing weighted hangs, reduces injury risk and also speeds up recovery between workouts. So I've been using one of these for months now. It is super portable, so I can easily bring it to the gym and to the crag for my warmups. And then I'm also using it to train up my endurance right now by doing 7-3 repeaters at 60% of my max, which is so easy, you guys, to program because the app just gives you a target to hit on each pull. And so as soon as I don't hit that target, I know that my session's done. Boom, that's it. I don't get injured. I don't get overly fatigued. I recover faster. With the Force Board, you can train anywhere. It is the future of finger training. Hit that link in your show notes or just pop over to thestruggleclimbingshow.com/Force Board and you can score 10% off your purchase by using code STRUGGLE at checkout. Y'all, I just want to give a little shout out here to Fizzy Vantage. I have been a paying customer of Fizzy Vantage for a couple of years now, and this stuff is truly the best of the best if y'all want to level up your training and your performance, and I know you do. I'll give you a little window into my routine here. There are a few Fizzy Vantage products that I take every day, whether I climb or not. First, I start my day with their superfood greens, which tastes delicious and is just the best way for me to get going in the morning. It supports my immune system and my digestive health. I just always feel like I'm good as long as I start my day with their greens. I also take their magnesium supplement every day, MAG-ATP, which, as it turns out, and I didn't know this, a lot of people are deficient in, and among other things, it helps me to improve my sleep, which of course is really important for recovery. Lastly, I take their supercharged collagen every day as well to support my tendons and ligaments so that I can train harder and recover faster. It is all science-backed stuff. It tastes delicious, which I think is also very important. And I can also say with absolute sincerity that I'm training harder right now than I ever have before, and I have never felt better. And I attribute that a lot to Fizzy Vantage and how it's helping me to recover and perform my best. So if you're looking for that extra edge, hit the link in your podcast app or use checkout code STRUGGLE15 to save 15% off any full price nutrition order at fizzyvantage.com. I really think you're going to feel the difference. Check it out. Okay, let's talk about tactics now. I've got a million questions for you tactically, but I guess before I get into my specifics, what comes to mind as something that you've struggled with regard to tactics?
That's interesting because when you say tactics, of course, the first thing I wanted to do was jump to the tactics of my mindset in the journey. So separating that to actually the physical process. Oh my gosh, I don't know if I've thought about this so much because it's never the physical parts that seem to get me. It's always the mental parts.
Well, I can give us a jumping off point if we want.
Yeah, give us a jumping off point. Then I'll go from there.
I think it was on, maybe it was on Queen Line. And you were just even in your To Bolt or Not to Be video, you're talking a lot about beta and how to keep beta straight. You got a beta Bible that you were talking about in on To Bolt, and then in on the line, was it Once Upon a Time or no, it was the one that you did after that. The
Walk of Life.
Yeah, Walk of Life. You created a story around the beta and this kind of thing. And you seem to have, at least from what I can glean, you can correct me if I'm wrong, but you seem to really not only be passionate about beta and really like to geek out about it, but also you seem to have a knack for it, which is something I absolutely do not. I'm telling you, I could do a climb 10 times and not be able to talk you through the sequence. So for whatever reason, I don't retain it very well. And especially as a climb gets longer, then it gets really hard for me. So I'm curious tactically if that's something that you've developed or if there's just been an ease about remembering sequences in beta.
Yeah, I mean, I think the reason I found your question hard is because I don't really struggle with this at all. As far as I've experienced, I just memorize beta pretty immediately. And then I memorize everyone else's beta. So if you climb with me, I actually cut it from the To Bolt film, but I have the beta for four other people's To Bolt climb
Amazing.
As well in my head. Yeah. So I just soak it up. Pretty much I did it once. And then I was okay, I've got an idea for this. And it took a while for me to be able to close my eyes and actually offhand do everything. But if I'm on the wall and I'm feeling the wall, I know what to do quite quickly. And also I read beta really fast. So I feel pretty much there was some tweaking, but my first go ended up being a lot of the beta I used on the send go, aside from figuring out how to fix my beta to not use my pointer finger.
Oh, right.
And then I was climbing with some shorter climbers, so I knew their beta. And it was funny because I was climbing with my friend Mary and she kept forgetting her beta. I'm right foot up. I'm on the little, she's here. And I'm yes.
Yeah.
She's did I do that last time? I'm yes, that's how you did it. So I'm the person that's yelling at the climber on the wall, oh, that's weird that you chose to use your left hand. And they're did I use my right hand last time?
That's me. Oh my gosh. Yeah. I just need you to come out with me to my project to help me on my beta. That's what I need. It's interesting though, because you're so good at it and it seems like you lock it in so quickly, does it ever have the effect where you're then not open to seeing alternatives?
No, that's a good question. I'm usually actually quite open to alternatives, and I'll constantly be like playing with beta, even if it's a working session. And actually, I think the problem why Tibolt took me a bit, I think something I learned from the Tibolt climbing process is that I was not in the projecting phase for long enough where I was like open to relearning beta, because I got so close on like my sixth session. So it was like my first week, I just like nonstop was on it. And then like right after that, I got so close to sending, I was like, cool, I've got this dialed. And then in my head, I was like, I almost did it. Now all I have to do is just put it together. And I think that really slowed down my process, because there were some micro adjustments I was able to make that made it a lot better. And I like switched one sequence at the top. So I think like I'm like, okay, I have to really be open till the end. If I'm falling, I have to be open to adjusting beta. But I would say a lot of that also came from the fact that, so I travel alone, right? So I went to Smith Rock and I just go to the bar and I see who wants to belay me on Tibolt, and I'll belay them on the dihedrals. And so every day I had a new climbing partner, and I feel really guilty taking up their time. So I'm like, I'm just red burning. And if I want to rework beta on a 35 meter route, you know how long that takes? I think what I have to do is start, I don't know, like asking and be like, okay, is it okay if I like take time to rework the beta, and I bring a separate rope to leave on the climb as a top rope after a red point or after I get the rope up? It's just like a really long process, and I feel bad for subjecting random people to it. So maybe I just need to, I don't know, I need to figure that part out a little better. Yeah.
Yeah, I love how self-conscious you are about that, because I do think that part of the climbing process is just like hanging on the rope and dogging at every bolt and figuring things out. And hopefully, you know, you've got a patient belayer, and then you get to return the favor when they're going on. Not every day is like a flash attempt or a red point go. So it's interesting that as a professional elite climber, you're still conscious about how long you take on a project.
I'll give up my go so a friend who's close to sending will be able to red point at the perfect time. I don't know. I just, it's especially because that's how I make friends as I travel. And I'm just so grateful that someone would want to climb with me for the day. I'm like, oh, great. Like, I have a climbing partner. I can climb tomorrow, that sort of thing. So I think I work around other people a lot in my climbing career. And I think it's hard. That's why climbing with Tom's so nice, because I'm like, oh, it's like a built-in climbing partner. I'm not used [S2] Right. [S1] To having that. I'm working on it. I think communication is just the best. Be like, look, as I always pick the longest climbs. I don't know. I love long climbs. So I'm like, look, okay, it's a long climb. It takes a long time to climb, and I'm going to need to work this out. Are you down for that kind of day? And then it's usually amazing. Whoever it is will be like, yeah, I'm working a long climb too, so I'm going to need a 2-hour belay. So we'll just do, it'll work out perfectly.
Right.
I think I just need to communicate that and make sure they give me the, it's okay. So then I have, I don't know, the confidence to stay on the wall as long as I want.
Yeah. I hadn't anticipated this question until you just brought this situation up of like where you travel alone, and so you're essentially climbing with different partners every time you go out. And what are the pros and what are the cons of having that many different climbing partners and belay partners, contrasted by the way with like somebody like myself and maybe a lot of people where you got your group and you usually go out with, like I typically go out with the same small handful of people every time I go out, which again, brings its own pros and cons, but I haven't done what you're talking about doing. So I'm curious what it's like to climb with a different person almost every time you're out.
Yeah, it gives me a lot of flexibility because I usually just find someone pretty easily, especially if it's in Smith, a place where everyone's roping up. So I get to climb on my own schedule, and I'm like, okay, I want to climb tomorrow. I don't want to climb tomorrow. And if I don't want to climb tomorrow, like I can just do a rest day or I don't know. It gives me more flexibility because I'm not with this group. I'm not like, okay, I'll belay all day then or something like that.
Sure.
And then I also think like for me, it's helpful to meet people, make friends. And okay, I don't know if you noticed, this might be like a little bit like random to say, especially because a lot of these people are like becoming closer and closer friends. But when you first meet someone or when it's within the first couple times, I don't know, like it's like newer friendships, like you really put your best self forward. So I find myself constantly challenging myself to just be the best version of who I am with new people always. And I think it's made me a better person. Like I'm like a little bit more composed on the wall. I like am more aware. I feel happier often when I'm with newer people because I So I'm just like, oh, like, we're just having a good time. We're getting to know each other. Like, this is all fun. This is like part of, it's like, it brings the social element back into climbing outside for me. So like with the Tybalt video, like that whole video was shot over just 1 week. So I had 1 week of projecting, I had 1 week to take off my fingers because I had a finger slit and I tried to heal it and it didn't work. And then I had 1 week of filming and then I sent on the last day. And so that was all with the same climbing partner who I knew. And I was like, I don't know, is this person they're familiar? And so all of a sudden you're like raging and you're like not putting on your best face. I don't know if any of that makes sense or if that relates to anyone, but I think it's nice to have the balance, right? To have someone you're really comfortable with, but also throw in a random new person while you're in the middle of projecting your project and see how your entire vibe changes. Like, instead of being like, why won't it go? You're okay. Like, you just mellow out, or at least I do. I mellow out so much and I like that.
Yeah, that's such a cool perspective. Thank you for sharing that. I do love that.
And I'm not sure if it's relatable at all. I'm like, I don't know if that's weird. I'm not trying to be two-faced either. It's just, I think it's just like your response to meeting new people, right? Like,
no, I think so. I had a conversation with Ollie Tor recently, and he echoed something very similar where he said that he used to get really passionate and sometimes like overly passionate, like negative or have a fit if the thing wasn't coming together. And that all changed when one day he went out with a young comm climber that he was mentoring, who was like, I don't know, 13 or something like that. And he told himself, what I want to do today, regardless of the outcome, is show this kid that you can try hard and not get swept up and swept away by the process. And he did that. And so when he didn't send, when he punted like a move from the chains or whatever, he came down and he just smiled and said, yeah, maybe we'll see it next time. And he said after that one thing, because he wanted to put on essentially, like you're saying, like the best kind of version of himself or this best face for to be a good mentor to this kid. But he said that just that one day has completely shifted. And now that's how he treats everything when he goes out. Like, it just like completely shifted the way that he allows his self or his emotions or whatever to come out at the crag. And not in a two-faced way, like you're saying, I think, but just in a way where he discovered that he can be happier and lighter and still try hard and still get the outcome that he wants. Yeah, there's something I think very interesting to that.
Yeah, I think I've had really good experiences with that. And now I'm like seeing, like with the Tybalt film, you can obviously see I'm having an emotionally difficult time. And I think like part of that is to do with that maybe, or the dynamic I was having. And yeah, I don't know. I'm not trying to blame the Blair. That doesn't seem like the best way to go. But like mostly, yeah, just not feeling like I was keeping that mindset, that fresh, okay, it'll happen. Like, maybe I just had a lot of pressure on me at the time as well. Yeah, I wish I could carry it with me while I did through everything. Like, I'll like did it once and then I have it forever. But I think I just need like reminders every now and then. Yeah.
And how great when you, as you're traveling around, you have those opportunities to meet people of different personalities and different temperaments and be able to discover things about yourself, but also see how they handle adversity and struggles and victories and these kinds of things. So yeah, that's cool. That chapter went like in such a different direction than I thought it was good, but I'm so psyched because I think it's a much richer look at that subject matter than we've had in quite a bit there. So I appreciate you sharing that new perspective. And this dovetails very well into mindset and mental game, which is what we're going to talk about right now. Let's talk about what has been or maybe what is a struggle for you in mindset. And then I've got a lot of listener questions and other things I want to jump into here.
Oh, right on. Yeah, mindset. Mindset's so tough, especially because just throwing it back to the very beginning, the very first question and my answer being like, I'm a really emotional, highly sensitive person. So things feel so intense to me. Like they feel so intense. And so if I don't do something, it's all. And then if I do, it's like, yes, and like everything is just on such an emotional roller coaster. So I feel like mindset is the hardest for me to control because it's just like it feels a little bit out of control. Like my emotions always feel a little bit too much. And I'm, you know, like I said, in adulthood, I'm like working on managing that and I'm working on embracing that. But it's still just like the toughest part. Like, how do you accept that it really matters and you really care about it, but also accept that it's totally fine if you don't do it? Like, how can you have two diametrically opposed ideas living in your brain at the same time and just like accept that? Maybe the biggest struggle I have in mindset is keeping it open and not being devastated when it doesn't happen. Maybe it's just like embracing the process a bit more. And I have a little bit of trouble with that, given that I feel like I still haven't been projecting at my limit, if I'm being honest.
let's peel back on this and then we can explore some of the other areas there. But I think that regardless of the grade that we climb at, I think that can be a universal feeling, is trying to keep that open mind and trying not to let the outcome dictate self-worth and happiness and these kinds of things. But to your point, easier said than done. There is some dissonance that happens in the mind where you want to try really hard for something, but also tell yourself, but it also doesn't matter that much, when clearly it does. Like, how are there tools that you use to try to deal with that dissonance? Or how have you worked through that now, especially as you're getting a little bit more into some bigger projects, especially if you're traveling halfway around the world and you've had to raise a bunch of money for it and this kind of thing, and there's maybe a little bit more pressure on the thing than if it was just like a gym session?
Totally. Yeah. Great points. I feel like that's a whole nother side of the coin that I don't know if people realize, but I have to raise money for every trip I do. And then if I don't send, guess who's not getting sponsored on the next trip, you know? So it's just like, okay, there's that little element of stress. But Sure. Yeah, I think a good way, like something I have embraced really is validating all of my emotions, even when they're opposites, because like humans are so complex and you can be sad and happy at the same time. Like I can be like, maybe I'm coming out of the depression, like I said, but like I can be depressed, but still have like intense moments of joy. Like I just went to a wedding yesterday. No, that was 2 days ago. It was so fun, so much joy. But that doesn't mean I'm not depressed still. So it's like, okay, if those things can live in harmony, so can everything else. Like opposites can live together. I think that's more like Eastern philosophy as opposed to our Western, like it must be one thing or the other. Yeah. And so like a good, like something I hear often at the gym really is, I know grades don't matter, but, and I'm like, okay, hold up, they can matter. And then the person who's talking to me is always like floored, like, what? But like, they're not supposed to matter. I'm like, then do they not matter to you? And they're like, and I'm like, they clearly matter. Like, I don't know. Like, I've done that too. I've been like, grades don't matter, but, and it's like, obviously they do. So why are we lying to ourselves? I think when you try to like mask your emotions or try to lie to yourself, that's where the problems come up. So if you can say, okay, fine. I'm going to be that person. I'm going to say grades matter to me. Now what? Okay. So they matter. I'm going to try hard. And I think it gives me space to like accept that that's how I feel, instead of feeling embarrassed or awkward or conceited about it. Or I don't know, the other range of secondary emotions you can feel when you are saying something a bit more taboo, right? And then you can just focus on working on how you're going to respond to the other elements of it, like failure or falling or not achieving that goal, because it does matter. And I think that's where you can make the most like growth, and that's where I'm working on it. Like I obviously don't have it like totally unlocked, but I think like validating everything is like the most important thing, because why would you lie to yourself and say they don't when they really do? And then how can you treat that with grace? I think that's the most important thing.
Yeah, validating all of those emotions. I really like that, even if they're in conflict or seeming conflict. Have you failed on, would you consider that you failed on anything in climbing yet?
No. But I have, but I don't think I've failed, because still tried it.
Have you not reached a big objective that you've set out to achieve?
No.
No.
This is the problem. So there's like this one climb I didn't get to do in Oleana before I left, and I was really sad about it. But then it like burned down and I can never do it again. That was like devastating. But also I'd only been trying it for a week. I don't know. I hadn't put that much emotional energy. And since then, every big objective I've set out to do, I've done, which I realize puts me in a really, like, it doesn't really give me much of a standing, does it, to talk about failure? But like, I'm going to try to push myself now. I was talking to Delaney Miller from Climbing Magazine for an article, and I was like, she's like, what are your goals this year? And I'm like, to fail more. And she's like, what are you talking about? I'm like, I want to not get a project. And I haven't managed to do that. I think I keep picking maybe under my strength level. But I think for me, when I pick projects, it's really important that it's like beautiful, it's aesthetic, the movement's good, and it looks like just like a queen line. Like I just want it to be amazing. And I'm working through my dream board. And so of course I'm starting at the easier climbs. And so now I'm going to get to the grades that are going to probably spit me out. That's my justification for why I've done every climb. I don't know.
No, but I think that's interesting. Like choice of project is something that I'm continuously wrestling with, because there's, what did Hazel say? To attain flow, it's where preparation meets challenge or something, like it's at the tip where if it's too easy, you can't get into flow. And if it's too hard, you can't get into flow because it's not achievable. It's like a pretty small little Venn diagram overlap there. And for you to say that maybe you haven't been challenging yourself quite as hard as you could obviously opens up some really exciting things with regard to climbing goals and the opportunity out there, but then also opens up the possibility that a project might not come together that first trip, or you might have to extend a trip, or you might have to walk away for a little bit. And is there a discomfort in that?
Yeah, but I'm more excited than uncomfortable. I'm like so excited for it. I have my next projects are like, or the next things on my dream boards or whatever are like quite a bit harder, I would say, than the climbs I've been trying. And that's mainly because I've been focusing on trad. And so you do want to climb a little bit under your physical limit. Although my hardest sends have really been on trad climbs, which is funny. So I'm thinking like sport climbs are a bit safer than trad, like pushing the limits. And I'm just so excited. I'm planning a trip to Smith to Recce, the other climb I want to do there. And it's so exciting because I'm only going to be there 2 weeks and my family's coming for 1 week. So I'm going to be putting up top ropes on easy climb. Like, it's not going to be like, I'm not going to be trying the climb. So I have like basically a week, maybe like a week and a half, depending on how psyched I get. And my whole plan, so excited. My entire plan is just to have the beta, to remember the beta, and then come home and train and then go back to it. And I've never done that because I've always been like, I'm just going to go and do this thing. But I'm really excited to try this approach. And it takes like the pressure completely off. I'm not going to send it in a week, okay? I'm not delusional. And like, I'm like really excited because it's like this low pressure thing on this climb that's harder than anything I've ever tried. And I like cannot wait. And I'm going to do the same thing for another climb close by. Like, they're both like the same grade and it's like it's like jumping a bit. And I'm just really excited to start this process that's going to be longer than anything I've ever done on two different climbs at once.
Yes. Oh, man. Yeah. I'm so hyped. I can see how psyched you are, but I'm psyched too. There's something very cool about learning the moves and then you just run them in your head every night when your head hits the pillow and you set the replicas and you train around it. And there's just so much psych and motivation around that. Cool. And that provides like a great opportunity for us to talk about fear for a second, because you're talking about how a lot of your hardest climbs are on trad, and now sport climbing can push a little bit harder because it's, relatively speaking, it's going to be safer with fixed anchors in the walls and bolts. I had some questions come in about fear of falling, because you've shared your fear of falling either overtly just recently into Bolt, where you open the film by saying, I don't like falling, and then you have this like great just like runner of like insane whips, but also on Prinsip and it's the other climbs that you've done where, whether it's a risk of gear pulling loose or just a really long fall, typically your MO is to fall, scream, immediately start crying, and then get back on the climb. And so people have been asking, and I struggle with this myself, I think a lot of people do, but how you've worked through this fear of falling.
It's an interesting one because it's had its ups and downs and it's not linear. So yeah, I am scared of falling, but it's getting better. And I'm doing it more, so it's like exposure therapy almost. And I did take Hazel's course. I was living with her for a week, I believe, in Catalonia while she was like setting up the course. And she's like, you should really just take this. And so I did do that. And I hope she's not disappointed that I haven't made too much progress, because I've just been like, I don't know, traveling, doing other stuff. But
you have made progress, though.
Some, not like as much as I'd want to. And maybe that's just because it's not been the highest priority, because I'm really psyched on training and travel. Some things have to get pushed aside. But I think this goes back to being an emotional person and an emotional climber, is using that almost as to my advantage. So when I really want something badly, it really overrides fear in that moment. If I want it so badly, like every part of my being wants it, like I'm not going to be thinking about the fall. I'm just going to be like attacking. So I think for maybe an onsite or a flash that I really want badly, I just kind of perform. I just go for it. And if someone's might have seen me at the crag and I'm just jumping into the unknown, like I remember I was like trying to flash something in the dark at 10 sleep and I just like jumped to a random hole I couldn't see and I stuck it and I was like screaming and it was like so fun. Yeah. And you wouldn't think that this person has any fear of falling, right? But then if I just don't want it as much, or like maybe I'm, I don't know, maybe I'm hormonal, maybe I'm on my period or something, or maybe like just not been the best week, I'm a little bit more depressed, I don't know, something's off, then all of a sudden like I let those emotions override And so the reason I'm saying that is that when I do these trad climbs and I'm really prepared, the emotion that overrides is not like necessarily wanting it super badly. If you've seen any of my trad climbs, like I want it, but I'm really calm. It's because I think the main emotion taking the lead is confidence.
Mm.
So I'm just so like confident that I can do it that like I just feel like I've got this. And I think that's the state I need to be in for trad climbing. And that's what's different from trad and sport, because for sport climbing, I feel like even before I'm confident, I'm going for leads because it's more about pushing that physical limit, you know, getting high points. And it's sure. not like you need to, I don't know, I treat trad climbing like, okay, don't fall. I'm doing dangerous stuff. It's like, you can't fall. Please don't fall on that gear. I'm like, this is a mental gear. Like, so none of it, especially for Walk of Life, I felt like Al wanted me to lower down and take pictures on some gear after I sent it and pull the rope. And he's like, is there any gear you feel comfortable in sitting on? And I'm just like looking and I was like, no.
Oh.
And he was like, what? And I was like, no, I don't. We'd have to go down to the bottom. There's a few pieces right before halfway. And I'm like, and then this whole second half is just all mental. Like, I'm like, I'm not going to sit on that gear. And then wow. there's like at the very top, there's a really good piece. So I was like, so I can do it at the very top. So that's why all the pictures that you see from Walk of Life are just like the top.
It's so, like, so wild. Oh my gosh. Half the route. So literally like you're decking, essentially. It's all like just little micro placements and mental. It's just mental gear, like you're saying.
It starts with sky hooks. Like you can't, your first piece, you like whittle in at 40 feet. That's the first piece that's not a sky hook.
My hands were sweating. It's absolutely bonkers. Because I remember you broke that down in like chapters, right? There's like chapters. Yeah. Your beta was like chapters. And that first, what was the first chapter? It was like absurd. Skyhook. Yeah, it was Skyhook. Because
the hook. Yeah, because it's like the hook of the novel.
The hook, yeah.
But also Skyhook. I just play with it. I just have little stories that I, yeah.
But it's just so bonkers to think about calmness coming in that scenario. Because you're saying like, it's not that the overarching emotion there to get past a fear of falling is like the psych to do the thing, but it's a calmness that comes from, I'm assuming, preparation, because you've worked it so much and you've rehearsed it and it's like you're just executing a routine at this point in time. But there's also like some real fear, and I've heard you say that it's quite hard for you to meditate or to sit still, that you're constantly like,
I have a fidget spinner that I have to be like using this whole conversation.
Like, yeah. So when one needs to attain some semblance of mental calm, when it's very challenging for you, is there anything that you do?
You know, maybe this answer could change when I have like more data to pull from, but right now I just feel like it is confidence. Like that's what the main driver has been, but I'm like thinking about it more now. And I feel like part of that also is to do with the fact that it's slab. So I'm not sure if different angles would change like what emotion is the best. Like I think sure. for slab, you just need pure confidence. Like you're like your faith in the foot that could like a smear or like tiny little edges. And you can't shake. You can't second guess. Like you have to just be confident. I feel like the most for slab climbing. And maybe if those climbs, like, cause to bolt, it wasn't confidence that wasn't driving me. Like I was like desire to just do it and to hold. I was like pure grit, because it's just such a long climb. You just have to be on it the entire time. And so I'm wondering if that's not like a trad versus sport thing, just in my head. And the reason why I was thinking that is because in sport, I'm going to push myself physically more, because that's the nature of, at least for me, like that's where I'm drawing my safety lines. You know what I mean? That's my risk reward line. And so for sport, I'm pushing myself in a way that's a little different, but I don't know. I haven't done, I feel like such a noob. Like I really haven't been doing this for too many years. Like I know that sounds so silly. Like, I know I've been climbing for 10 years, but like 6 years was bouldering and I loved it. I was so psyched about it. But I was also like going to school and like focusing on career and doing other stuff. And then it hasn't been till like recently that I'm like pushing things. And yeah.
It's
yeah.
really cool. It's just like the idea of you just scratching the surface of your potential in these different disciplines is really exciting, because you have ascended very quickly through the ranks and you've got incredible talent. So to be able to get focused and put yourself into some of these other areas is really freaking exciting. I'm stoked. So the last thing I want to ask you about in mental game before we shift to our final chapter here is about visualization. And I remember when you were working on Prinzip Hoffnung and you hit like a stretch of bad weather and there was like a lot of visualization work that it seemed like you were doing. And I'm curious how you use visualization to stay active without being on it, if that makes sense.
Yeah, I feel like it keeps you fresh in your mind. We mentioned the Beta Bible, so I'll write down the climbs in the Beta Bible before I really have them memorized. Like, it's just when I'm there, like, I chunk it out, and I'm, like, trying to map it out. And it's not at the point where I can, like, close my eyes and do it. It's more, like, at the point, like, what I was saying, when you're on the wall and you're like, oh, I know what to do in this section, because you're, like, there and your body knows what to do and you see you have all the visual stimulation. So I think taking it one step past that and, like, no longer having that and doing it all in your mind, I think that's, like, a really cool point to get to, because you're really just, like, you guys, it's almost like you get to climb without even getting tired. It's great. Like, you can just imagine it. And I feel like I do have quite a vivid imagination. And so for me, it's really pleasant. And for Princip specifically, I, like, put on my big headphones and I would, like, blast really hyped music, like whether it was electronic music or whatever pop song I was listening to at the time. And I just walk down the street and I'm just, like, doing the climb and I'm just, like, you know, pretending to grab the gear in my mouth and placing it. And I'm just climbing this climb, like, I don't know, 10 times while I walk around the block. People probably think I'm crazy because, like, I'm in Austria. I don't look Austrian. I obviously am this foreigner visiting their small town, and I'm just doing crazy things while headphones on the street and just jamming and feeling psyched. I was, like, so excited, and it was, like, raining. It's, like, raining and I'm outside just, like, yeah. So I don't know. I find it, like, really fun. And also I like to obsess about things, and it gives me a fun excuse to obsess about things. And
when you're going through that, just, like, getting a little bit granular here for a second, are you visualizing the feet and the hands and the positioning and
the texture?
Oh, yeah. Okay.
And the smell of the rock and then the chalking up and then you just climb the whole thing. And then you send it. You don't let yourself fall. Even when you're gripped, you just keep going. Even if you got to your high point and then you just keep going and you imagine how it would be to keep going. And you really imagine every hold perfectly, you know, like, I enjoy doing it, especially when I can't get to the rock. And yeah. I like that part of the process. I like knowing exactly what's coming, because then when I'm climbing it, there's no surprises. There's no, oh yeah. It's just like, I've got this. Like, I know what I'm doing.
And you get to send it, which is great.
You get to send it in your head as many times as you want. It's amazing.
I need to do more of that, I think, on my proj. I need to just send it, because I usually visualize everything and I get up to the point and I'm like, okay, this is where I always come off. And so, like, I'm kind of reinforcing the fact that I keep coming off here. I'm sure Hazel would yell at me, because then I get up there and I'm like, oh, this is where I fall.
Although I've heard some people be like, don't visualize sending it all the way, because then you'll feel like completed, and you don't want to feel completed apparently before you don't want the satisfaction. And so maybe the advice is to, like, replicate it until the very last hold and you're grabbing the rope and you're about to clip anchor and then you fall. I don't know. I'm like, or maybe you just grab the chain. Like, you cop out. You're like, look, I got to the top. Yeah. I don't know. You do something in your head to differentiate it. I forget who told me that. I think it was my friend Sophie. I don't know. Someone told me, like, but you can't send it or else you'll get complacent. Oh, okay. That makes sense.
Oh my gosh. This is like a horror movie where if you die in your dream, you die in real life. Like, if you send it in your dream, you won't send it in real life.
Yeah. I'm like, okay, I'm not trying to jinx that. So maybe I'll, like, almost send it.
I love it. I want to talk about, like, things that you're passionate about outside of your own climbing, your channel and your content, your filmmaking, your creativity. All of that comes to mind. I've got some specific questions, but maybe this is a good entry point into it. So tell me, what is it? What is it that's, like, driving you and bringing you a lot of fulfillment?
Yeah, I love making films. It's so new. It's so fun. Like, oh my gosh, it's just been such an amazing journey being able to do that kind of in concert with my climbing. And I don't know, sometimes it feels really weird. So I'm like, I'm just making films about myself. Like, that's the weirdest thing ever. But, like, it started with a camera, right? And I'm like, I'm not going to subject anyone to my, like, terrible editing and video making. So of course, like, I'm going to do it on myself just because I have the control, right? Like, it just makes sense. And I'm, like, always there. I'm my own test subject. And so that's how it started. And I'm like, I'll give YouTube a shot. And I've just learned so much about editing, about filmmaking. Usually I'm in front of the camera, so not as much about the cinematography side of it, but I'm learning through editing and I think through the process and directing as well a lot about it. And it's just given me so much joy. It's, like, such a creative outlet, and it's the thing I love to do the most. And I've gotten to a point right now with YouTube where I'm trying to put out videos that I'm actually just really passionate about. And it's like 2024, a new me, but I was, like, doing a lot of videos, like once a week, and some of them were like stupid gym videos, and that's awesome. I love a good time. I love a good fun gym video, but I don't think it's really what like drives me as like creatively. It's just something to post. So I'm trying to be a bit more intentional with it and maybe slide in a goofy video or two here and there, but really focus on these passion projects where I get to like edit them and really push myself creatively. I feel like Tobolt was one, like my best edit so far. And I felt really proud of it when I made it. And it took a long time. I was editing it in Thailand, actually, while I was directing another film. So I was all sorts of all over the place. I was just like so happy. And then the videographers I was working with in Thailand, I like showed them a draft. And I think Felix cried. And I was like, okay, so it's good. And like, I don't know, it's really cool to like start entering this world and then to get the validation from other people in this world that are like, this is, you've come so far, you're doing a good job, keep going, and hopefully tell other people's stories once I have the confidence to do that. That's what I'm doing with the Thailand film, but I haven't felt confident enough to tell other people's stories because it's like, it's such a precious thing to be so vulnerable and let a filmmaker tell your story and to convey the essence that is you. Like, I've had films be made about me that I didn't have any part in the production, like Queen Lines. And I can't tell you how nervous I was because I didn't have control. And I was like, what if they make me look like someone I'm not? What if they cut together sentences and make me say things I don't mean? And what if, I don't know, it's just so vulnerable. You can do so much with editing. I know I'm an editor. Like, I can make you say whatever. So like, you know what I mean? Like, it's crazy. So I don't know. I guess that's like a little tangent on filmmaking.
No, I like that. It's been an interesting evolution, I feel like, with your content from being very raw, just kind of vlog style type things to goofy, funny, YouTube-y kind of gym challenges, collabs to these films now that have an emotional arc and are very thoughtfully and beautifully cut with music. And a lot can be done in post-production that makes it more polished and less raw. And so I'm curious how much thought you put into the calculation there of what your content will look like or what you're going to make available to people who enjoy following your journey and your story with regard to how polished certain things will be and how maybe raw or unpolished it will be. And then there's of course the equation too, like the YouTube equation, because this is your livelihood, about just needing to churn out content to appease the algorithm and this. So yeah, how do you think about like just like your channel holistically?
That's the biggest thing. So like, I like how you differentiated polished and unpolished, because I think like I don't mean to diss my funny videos, because I think like what you're saying holds a weight to it. Like there is this like element of just like raw, like it's me, and like when you met me, you're like, right now, you're just like, I feel like I know you already. Right. And I really like that element. I like the humanization of something unpolished. I like the gritty, awkward, like, maybe even like, just not the best edit, like just pushed together. Is there a storyline? Maybe, who knows? But we're just out here having fun, like we're just doing our thing. And I love that element of the gym videos. And I think like, for me, trying to make YouTube a career and like work has been difficult because it requires you to post so consistently so much. You always have to have another idea. And I think it like is a creativity drain. And so maybe like when I'm saying like 2024 new goals, it's not like getting rid of that unpolished content, because I really love that. But it's more like doing it on my own terms and doing it my own way. And so what I'm doing is cutting down how much I'm posting. So I used to post every week, which was wild. But I will tell you, I saved up a lot of money and was able to really comfortably take this last month when I was pretty depressed and low off. So grateful for a lifestyle that allows me to do that. And I'm glad I grinded so I could have this time now for myself and my mental health. So there's obvious benefits to doing the grind, but I feel like I'm at the point where I can post every other week and have better content. And better doesn't necessarily mean more polished. It just means my heart's clearly in it. Yeah. And I'm clearly doing exactly what I want to do, instead of being like, okay, I have this sponsor ad that I need to make, and so I need a video that goes with it. That's how it was. Like, and I'm not saying I like those videos. They're fun and we're still having fun, but I was just like showing up at the gym drinking. When you see me drinking caffeine like this, that means I'm not like, like I'm not enjoying it. Like, you know, I'm just like, I gotta be, it's like, it's work. And I understand that work is a thing that people need to do, but I feel like I can make a life for myself where the part that feels like work is really minimal. So yeah, instead of like having these ads and needing to make a video for it, I really like to make the video or have the video concept that I want to make, and then getting an ad for that. And I think that the ordering of that is going to be really essential to my happiness and my creativity. And then obviously I can't like send a climb like to Bolt or Princip or Once Upon a Time or Walk of Life or Quarryman. I can't do that every week, right? And I can't do that every other week even. So I think like those nuggets are going to drop when they do, when I can. And it's going to be like a really beautiful like part of my YouTube that I hope people can accept those films with the goop. Like, I don't know. I don't want to have one type of film. Yeah. Okay. I think I'm done.
No,
I think
like that's
that. I'm like, I don't know. There's a lot to say, but
I like that. And just like putting my producer hat on, having, you know, come from the entertainment industry for the last 20 years, I feel like you've done a very good job on your channel establishing that you put out more than one kind of video. I'm curious what the ambition is with regard to how you make a livelihood. And does it go beyond YouTube, or are you feeling like this is your zone?
Yeah, I mean, I mentioned making films about other people. Like, I do have ambitions for the future. I've been putting a lot of my films now, maybe not a lot, but like the ones that I'm really proud of, I've been submitting them to film festivals. I don't know how to really do it, but
Didn't Hope play or get some awards at festivals?
It's playing in festivals now. It has been selected for 7 international festivals, not including the local ones that just play it. And it's won 3 best sport film awards. So that's pretty cool. And then I've had other films also start being selected and winning festivals, which is cool because also these don't have a budget. Like, these are just films. Like, half of Hope is on an iPhone. It's me. And that's not, like, we had a videographer. I was able to hire one for 3 days. And a lot of these things, like, I don't feel like people realize. For that one specifically, I was able to get sponsorship for the videographer to come for 3 days. So I was really excited because I didn't have to pay out of pocket. But I think a lot of people don't realize, like, I hire people, I pay them out of pocket. Like, these are just my passion projects, just for the opportunity to do that. I lost so much money on the To Bolt film because I don't have any sponsors for it. Like, my sponsors just didn't pick it up. Hmm. And that's on them. There's not, like, the climbing industry is not lucrative, but I just told myself I want to invest in myself. And I think that's a step that is going to get me really far. I've been so stingy with my money. I was penny pinching when I started climbing because obviously, like, how do you climb and like make money? Like, you don't. You work random jobs. You work at night, and then I would hike out to the crag and I would hope someone would be there so I could climb with them because I was like, I'd wear bright colors. One of my photographer friends, Felipe, he always laughs because he was like, you just wore bright colors so photographers would take pictures of you at the crag, and then you'd be like, can I use that for Instagram? So that's how I got my first pictures. I would just wear the craziest things because I just really wanted. Yeah, I would just go out to the crag wearing like a crazy bandana head, like, you know, bright, bright, bright. And I'd just be like out there, and then someone would be like, hey, like, you just look so cool in that rock. I got a picture of you. I'm like, great. Can you send it to my Instagram? Can I use it? I'm trying to get sponsored. Like, I did everything I could to try to get money for climbing because it's what I really wanted to do. Anyways, that was a side tangent.
I want to talk about this. I really, let's open this up because I got a question from a climber. Let me pull it up here. Ethan wrote, I'm curious what you've done to make ends meet, to essentially be able to live the life of a climber. And is this concept of being a dirtbag dead, or are we able to live a life of climbing without necessarily having standard income stream?
That's a great question, Ethan. Yeah, like, my first advice is basically give up comfort. It's a horrible, I mean, like, once I decided I didn't need to be comfortable, the world was my oyster, right? So I lived like in a dilapidated car. I lived in a cave. I lived on people's couches. I lived in someone else's van. I lived in a pigsty. Lived everywhere just for the chance at climbing.
All right, y'all. I'm just going to fade us out here on this episode because that patron question that she started in on right there just leads into some other patron questions and some incredible stories and avenues that really go into bonus episode territory, which I like to do. Every episode I do a bonus episode where we dive into topics beyond the main format here. And this just might be my favorite bonus content ever on the show, you guys. As you can hear, she's about to dive into something really, really cool there. I mean, it's really profound what she just started there, which is like, if you don't need to be comfortable. The world is your oyster. I mean, what a cool jumping off point into what comes next, which is Anna sharing how scrappy she got as she embraced discomfort to live the life of a full-time climber. She shares some really creative ways that we all might be able to pay the bills if we are willing to think outside of the box. And spoiler alert here, we go off on a pretty fun tangent about selling feet pics, which Anna has been able to parlay into some serious income. And then she coaches me on how I could do the same, which I think she's going to regret, because when I launch my own competitive feet pics page, it is on. And then after we go down that rabbit hole for a while, we get serious. We talk about how she's training for steeper climbs, which she's been getting into recently, how she uses flexibility to climb harder than her strength would suggest that she would be able to do, how she can take her hands off of the wall when others cannot, using her flexibility and mobility. She shares her favorite exercises for improving range of motion, which I've been doing every morning since we had this conversation. And we also hear her heartfelt answer to a question posed by Tom Randall. And then there's just so much more that happens in that bonus episode, which is also available as a full video for patrons. Man, it is so good. You can get instant access to all of that right now for zero cost, you guys. How cool is this? With a free trial over at patreon.com/thestruggleclimbingshow, or also right there in your Apple Podcast app. If you're an iPhone person, you can just double click and get all of that bonus stuff right now, including more than 40 hours of bonus content with other crushers from Adam Andra to Chris Sharma, Nina Williams, Alex Honnold, Dave McLeod, so many more. It's all over there. And I also highly recommend you check out Anna's Patreon, which I am a member of, and she shares some really cool stuff there just for patrons. Like, I just recently got from her a video of the crux of her new project, which is Necessary Evil, and how she's training on that at home on the moonboard. It's really good stuff, and also just feels good to support Anna in all that she's doing. So check that out when you check out my Patreon. And by the way, you've still got a few days here. I'm looking at the calendar. It's not April yet. You've got a few days to enter to win a free pair of Scarpa shoes of your choice just by joining my Patreon at any level, including as a free trial member. So now is a great time to check all that out. Huge thanks and appreciation to our show sponsors who have brought you this episode at zero cost. Thank you all. Check your show notes for links and special discounts from those guys that are only available to Struggle listeners. And by the way, you can see all of the show's brand sponsors and special secret deals by popping over to thestruggleclimbingshow.com/deals. Hey, did you know that The Struggle is carbon neutral in partnership with the Honnold Foundation? Well, now you do. They are just doing amazing work to bring clean energy to communities around the world. Get inspired by their latest grant recipients over at honnoldfoundation.org and toss them some love if you can. They are just truly doing such good work for the world. And lastly, The Struggle is a proud member of the Plugtone Audio Collective, a diverse group of the best, most impactful podcasts in the outdoor industry. This show was produced and hosted by me, Ryan Devlin. All right, that clips the anchors on this one. And hey, if you liked it, would you consider just taking 30 seconds to rate and review this show on Apple or Spotify? It's a totally free way to support the work that I'm doing here in the podcast/utility closet, and you'd be surprised how much it helps. So if you have a couple seconds, please do that. Thank you. I love you. I hope your training and climbing are going great. And if you're struggling like me, well, at least the struggle makes us stronger.